From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro spoke at a press conference early Thursday. This was his response to a question from CGTN, that's China's global television network.
Do you feel Venezuela is now on the path to recovery following the election of the new Constituent Assembly? What are your next steps in your country's economic recovery?
Muy buena pregunta. Pienso que el daño que se ha hecho...
Excellent question. I think the harm that has been inflicted upon our country, especially in the last 4 months of violence, has a human toll. In Venezuela, something terrible has happened. When I saw the images of Charlottesville, my hope was that U.S. citizens never have to suffer from fascist hate. Because in our country, 29 people were burnt alive because they were suspected of being Chavistas, or because the color of their skin was brown, like mine, or because of their humble origins, they looked poor. 9 of those people died, and the 20 that survived are scared for their lives. Of course, because this was done by the right-wing anti-Chavista opposition, the international media was silent. So, recovery will take time, but the National Constituent Assembly has already shown its power. Venezuela is in peace. And now we need to consolidate that peace. I am pretty sure that the Constituent Assembly was the right way to restore peace in our country. And I am pretty sure that the Constituent Assembly, within these 2 years, will protect our country, allowing us to resume the path to economic growth, income redistribution, and social development of the country.
For more on the situation inside Venezuela, we spoke with Carlos Perez, who was born there and... after moving as a teen to Canada, has lived again in the embattled South American country for the past years. We spoke with him via Skype Tuesday. So, Carlos, first, give our audience a brief bio. I understand that you were born in Venezuela, grew up in Canada, and then started re-engaging with the Latin American region as an activist. So, give us a little bit of that.
Well, I mean, growing up in Venezuela until I was an early teenager gives you enough of a perspective on the world, but you don't really find your voice until you start being asked to take part. And that occurred when I was a bit older, and that occurred in Canada. So after living for Canada... I started becoming more active in the community, more active in the school, more active I was being asked to represent the voice of Latin Americans because no one was speaking out. And little by little, I started gaining an idea of the responsibility that it is to be part of the diaspora, part of the struggling community that's Latin America. And It became a vocation. So in university, I started organizing groups regarding human rights and Latin American causes and Latin American history. Essentially, the spearhead was the Zapatista cause at the beginning. And that pretty much developed our ideology and our methodology.
And this was, early 1990s, maybe?
Yeah, 94, 95.
Right, okay.
And by 96, we already were organized and moving about. But took about a year kind of to get organized. And it was people from different countries, not just... I was the only Venezuelan, in fact. Venezuelans were not really part of the activist scene back then. And they were left-wing, not right-wing as they are now.
Right.
I was essentially brought up by Chileans, Guatemalans, Salvadorians, Argentinians, just a whole bunch of people who had fled their countries for different reasons, but essentially the same problem when you study it closely. And they essentially were my mentors. So Venezuela started happening in 98, and the idea of Venezuela being a rebellious community or a country or a beacon of hope, that was new to me. I always knew Venezuela, growing up middle class, as a good servant to the greater cause of, you know, democracy and capitalism. Mm. So that shifted my identity and that remolded me.
Yeah, for people, just for reference, when you make reference to 1998, this is when Hugo Chavez was first elected. And so 98-99 is when the Bolivarian Revolution is sort of becoming part of the institutional operation of the government, of the country.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the interesting part is that for us, Chavez was a reference, but we didn't take him that seriously at first, because we have seen leaders come from the military in Latin America, and whether it was by election or by a coup, take over and become this, I would say, guard dogs of capitalism, a la Pinochet and a la many others.
Yep.
Latin Americans, it's filled with history like that.
Or idiosyncratic stuff, like if you look at like Perón, for example, in Argentina. Right.
And even Perón is a bit dubious, but I mean, because he was a nationalist.
Right.
But when you have people who just become guard dogs of corporate interest, you start having less and less hope for the potential of a military man winning an election and taking over as a democratic and socialist, even at that, you know, much less leader. So for us, it became, okay, he was there, he was in power, but we didn't take him that seriously because we're skeptic until the Constitution in 99. And that really opened our eyes to what this guy meant or what this guy was doing. So when that Constitution is ratified and understanding how progressive it was, we started paying attention, that's for sure. But we still had him in the background because we had our hands full with Colombia and Zapatistas and a few other causes, but really Colombia took our time. As Uribe was in power and Plan Colombia was in full effect. So
hey, before you move on, Carlos, just one very quick thing. It could give maybe a 10-cent description of the process of adopting the, you know, the thing that was unique or the things that were so unique about the Constitution that they adopted in 1999.
Well, recognizing Aboriginal rights, recognizing, I would say, women's rights. And, I mean, it was just a transformation, complete transformation.
Right.
It was not a middle-class base or middle-class-oriented constitution. It was not a liberal constitution, but it was a social-democratic constitution. And at this point, I don't have it in front of me. I don't have notes in front of me.
Right.
But I can tell you that we were very impressed as a Latin American community.
Yeah. I'm talking more like just the process of adopting it with the, you know, they had, it came from the bottom up. Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah, democratic. Well, you know, and that's something that we, at the same time, you can always manipulate that, right? You can always claim that you're democratic, but not being really democratic.
Right.
And being in Canada, we didn't have an awareness.
Right.
So for us, whatever they said, we were skeptic.
Right.
We did not really, but until we actually looked at it and read it.
Mm.
Is when we were impressed.
Yep. Okay, so go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's not a problem. So when we actually saw the Constitution is when we were impressed. And when we started reading the critiques of the Constitution and the analysis of the Constitution from third parties in the first world and in the academic world, is that when we realized people are taking it seriously.
Right.
And this is a shift in Latin American discourse.
Mm-hmm.
For us, that became the key. That became a calling card of saying, you know what, this is different. This is not the typical military leadership taking over and serving the neoliberal agenda. This was a whole different ballgame.
Mm.
And that, to us, shifted the Latin American focus from one of victim to one of protagonist.
Hmm. So now we move forward. That's in 99, 2000, 2001. Suddenly, April of 2002, there's a coup.
Correct. That's the big one. As I said, being brought up politically by Chileans, Guatemalans, and all kinds of people who have been betrayed and stabbed in the back by the corporations and their allies. You know, April 11th, 2002, I was in an office in Ottawa, in Carleton University, actually. And next thing you know, I hear the news, and it was devastating because I had Allende in my mind
right. The
whole day. And people who were my mentors came to the office to give me the condolences. So all of that day into the night, I was hearing, I'm sorry for your loss. So I started emailing and calling, and I had no power, had no access, no links, no idea.
Right.
So people, you know, call you all kinds of names because you are weak, you're a crybaby, you are powerless, you are useless, you're just another one in the bucket of history.
Right.
And, I thought that was it, like everybody else. Until 2 days later, you know, a day and a half later.
Right.
And I realized that my people, the people I underestimated growing up, showed me a different face, showed me a different dimension that they had never shown me before. And I have seen it from other people, other countries, other nationalities, other cultures, but never from the Venezuelan people. And this was the first time I realized there's more to my people that I have to learn about.
Yeah.
And I became involved pretty much then and there.
Yeah, and this was a pretty unique moment in history, too. If you think about it, you mentioned, for example, being raised by people from Chile and Guatemala in particular, both places that have suffered coups, backed by or committed by the United States, that, you know, led to long, decades-long periods of genocide, in essence, of, knock on the door, disappearance, murder, bodies floating in the rivers, things like that, and a hopelessness that comes with the coup. And in 2 days, the people of Venezuela said, uh-uh, and they pushed the coupsters out and brought back their government.
Absolutely. I mean, they were essentially starting the process of revolutionizing society. And to think of how fragile the organizations were on the ground. And they showed their character. I mean, it was really their character that took them through, because the movement was still very young. It's not like today. Today is a different story.
Right.
Back then, you know, if you had questions, you had them with justification. Because you did not know yet what was to come. And that's an interesting aspect of Venezuelan society.
Mm.
You know, back then, it wasn't aware of itself as much as it is now. So to think of them as pushing back the coup, to me, it's remarkable. Quite remarkable.
Yep, right. It's interesting, though, if you think about what's been happening in the country, particularly since the passing of Chavez and the election of Maduro after he had become president as a successor to Chavez, you know, the outright rebellion, in essence, by the right wing, the success that they had in capturing the National Assembly after several years of economic warfare and all of the implications that had for the people and for popular support of the government, the folks that would and do defend the Bolivarian Revolution have a decade and change, almost a decade and a half of experience under their belt that they didn't have, and institutionally in terms of defense of the revolution, that also exists. These things did not exist in 2002, and I don't think when analysts here say, oh, Maduro's in trouble, etc., that they have a full understanding of exactly what our side looks like when it's, rolling up its sleeves.
Yeah, well, when you think of it, this is really their third round.
Yep.
The coup in 2002 was really the second round, as the year of the elections, 1998.
Yeah.
The right was all over the place trying to catch Chavez. And Chavez writes about this in his different anecdotes about having to guard bridges and guard towns and send intelligentsia to of his own, essentially street organized or locally organized bodies or Bolivarian circles, as they call them eventually.
Right.
To make sure that there weren't bombs and there weren't, hitmen or anything like that. So, you know, the seeds were planted there during that election process, during that campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And even to go, that's the threat. And the threat it was significant, as the CIA and the State Department were already aware of Chavez.
Right.
From way before.
Of course.
As the intelligentsia were aware of the different Bolivarian movements within the army,
mm-hmm.
before Chavez. So for Chavez to take this threat seriously during his 98 elections, that tells you that there was some organization and some knowledge or some culture that was brewing that allowed for the 2002 resistance and then the death of Chavez in 13 or 14?
Yeah. I don't remember what the date, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And essentially that deflated the balloon, you know, in the community. I mean, when I came here, it was around just after.
Yeah.
And
it was March 5th, 2013.
Right. I mean, that completely took the wind out of their sails.
Okay.
At the ground level.
I remember.
Maduro was essentially handed an empty balloon, you know, to work with.
Yep, I remember. Yep.
So, yeah, it was. An easy victory for the opposition, because
yep.
they banked on it. They essentially put all their chips on Maduro is not Chavez.
Right.
That was the phrase. Maduro is not Chavez. Don't count with Maduro. He's not Chavez, and he's just a bus driver. You know what does he know? You know.
And this was after not for nothing. They had spent the entire time from 1998 until 2013. Condemning Chavez, in every which way, and all of the for people that aren't familiar with it, the media landscape in Venezuela, like much of South America in particular, and much of the rest of the world in particular, by the way, you have corporate media dominates 80-90% of the media scape, and then there is perhaps in some places, and there's one TV channel at the time in 2002, for example, in Venezuela. State-run.
Yep.
In other words, a public station. They call it state-run media, but it's public. In other words, it's not corporate. You can use it. And so that 24/7, Chavez is no good. Chavez is, they called him a monkey, all kinds of things. And then suddenly when they saw the people were out in the streets crying over his passing and they loved him, suddenly, well, Chavez was great. Maduro's not Chavez. And they start calling him monkey and whatever else they can call him.
Absolutely. You know, you transfer the discourse. You know, you put it on Maduro, and Maduro doesn't have the track record that Chavez does, of course.
Right.
And, he was playing with his back against the wall. That's what was happening.
Yep.
So I was here for those elections, and it was very easy to see that the Chavistas were going to lose. It was definitely there was already a campaign in the ground of people raising hell, people complaining. When the supermarkets would open, there were these rich folks who would essentially buy off the supermarket.
Right.
And they would leave you with an empty supermarket to grab whatever was left.
Yeah.
I remember there was no meat, no milk. It was crazy. Yeah. And you could see it coming. But the people, although they, once they lose the elections, the next day, I remember being on the bus and you could see their heads down.
Mm.
not because the Chavistas lost, but because they lost it.
Yeah, just the personal ownership of the, you know. I just want to clarify for people, the elections we're talking about now are the 2015 elections for the National Assembly.
Yeah, December 6th.
Right.
Yeah, that was, they still were, you know, when the opposition supporters go on the street, a lot of them will wear a hat with a D6, December 6th.
Yep.
This to remind you. And, yep. But the problem they had, you know, when they took power, is that they were so confident that they were going to overthrow Chavez.
Right. You're talking about what the right wing thought when they won the 2015 election, right?
They took over parliament, and right. From the first moment they broke protocol, they were insulting the army.
Yep.
They were taking down pictures of Bolivar, pictures of Chavez.
Yep.
They were essentially remodeling the whole place.
Yep.
Without the consent of the people.
And they disregarded the Supreme Court, who said there were three seats that were contested. The Supreme Court found against the opposition candidates. It did not mean that they lost their majority, and yet they ignored it and continued to operate in session with them. In other words, rendering everything they did after that illegal and with just total impunity and arrogance.
Completely. And they also started essentially a promising a coup without a coup.
Right.
They said 6 months. In 6 months, we are going to take power. In 6 months. They kept repeating that.
Yep.
And, of course, it was completely incoherent with the Constitution, which meant they were really not recognizing the Constitution.
Right.
In fact, the very first day in the first day of Congress, Ramos Alup, who's the leader of the right wing at the time, he states that they have to change the Constitution and go back to the 1961 Constitution.
Mm.
So they have to go back in time, essentially, erase what's been done. And that raised alarms everywhere. So, but, you know, they still have the economic power. That's what the problem was. They still had all of this leverage that they could say whatever they wanted to say, but in the end they could apply it, you know, to a large degree. And I personally thought that the people could break. They were in that kind of position. So years go by, and all of this crisis starts accumulating. But then you see the government react, going the counteroffensive. And about 2 years ago, I would say, but really effective last year. And with the different social programs and the food program. And that changed the mood of the right wing and pretty much the confidence in the left. I got involved in that program myself.
Mm.
And what it is, because the inflation was so high and the black market so dominant, the government decided to import food, sell it at the proper price, and give the families opportunity to have food on the table at a decent price without having to go to the black market to buy their staples.
Right.
So there's a program that's still around and still evolving. And what occurred was that the people, even the opposition supporters, were starting to shift on the ground. Hmm. So when the Guarimbas of this year happened, there was no support. Whereas the ones 3 years ago happened, and there was a lot of support.
Right.
Right? So 3 years ago happens, they have the Guarimbas, and they have the elections, and they win the election with a lot of support. This year, they have the Guarimbas and the plebiscite, the attempt to essentially somehow overthrow the government by some weird kind of vote that doesn't exist.
Right, yep.
And also not taking part in the proper constituent elections or for the assembly.
Right.
Not having any candidates, which was essentially giving the game over to the left. But sure enough, they didn't see that one. And next thing you know, the people on the right wing were so tired of the economic crisis, and they knew where it came from. They understood who were the players and how it was done, how it was manufactured, that when it came time to support the Guarimbas, the people stayed home.
which is sort of a symmetrical action of what happened in 2015, because a good part of the reason, doing some analysis of the numbers for the right capturing the National Assembly in 2015, was that a number of supporters of the government in the, say, in the 2014 presidential election, for example, or 2013, whatever Maduro's election was after the passing of Chavez, some of those folks stayed home for the National Assembly election, the same phenomenon that we saw in Argentina. In other words, it wasn't that there was support that increased for the right, but rather support for the left had softened as a consequence of the economic crisis, and which was being, as it turns out, unfairly laid at the feet of the government, of the leftist governments.
I think it was a combination of the left losing steam and the right gaining it. The right provided the message: if you vote for us, we will give you food. We will give you
right. We'll fix it.
Yeah, we'll fix it. We'll essentially provide you all you need, but just give us the vote.
And when they got in, that's not what they did. They got in, and instead they started tearing down posters of Chavez and et cetera, et cetera.
Well,
and people still didn't have any food.
Dismissed the country. Dismissed the powers. Dismissed the democratic order. They dismissed
everything.
Everything.
And so they got to crashing helicopters into the Supreme Court at the last month or month before.
Yes. No, I mean, the right wing self-destructive.
Yep.
That's what it comes down to.
Yeah.
And what occurred was that they created their own crisis by not responding to their campaigns responsibly. Mm. And they lost all of the support, even within their ranks, and today there made this chaos in that community.
Right. All right. So now we've got the Constituent Assembly is starting to operate. And maybe the next time we speak, we can go into some depth about exactly what the legal aspects of that and how it operates as an institution. But you've got now a handle on the problem of an oppositional legislature, where you now have some legislative functions that can be performed in concert with the presidency. In other words, some things can actually get done now. A focus on solving some of the economic problems, a defanging of those who were creating some of those economic problems. And so how do we see, things moving forward, say, over the next few months, over the next year or whatever? Because we got the presidential election coming up next year.
Yeah, well, I mean, the first one was dealing with the fifth column. Within the system, there were a lot of people operating under the Chavista campaign or on the Chavista, I would say, mantle, that were essentially playing corruptly or essentially were handing the game over to the opposition, mm-hmm. Such as the Governor General.
Yep.
The Governor General was essentially part of the right wing, and her husband, he was a prominent politician who organized extortion rackets in both the political sense and the economic sense. And that's a serious, serious problem, of course, but it wasn't fixed until the Governor General was removed by the new Constituency Assembly.
Right. Now we're talking about Luisa Ortega, yes?
Yes, correct. Right. And, she was clearly protecting the Guarimbas, protecting the extortion rackets, protecting the black market, and allowing the political fabric to undo itself and to be undone by the right wing. I mean, essentially, she was an agent, the major agent, I would say, of allowing things to happen and allowing the coup to be plausible.
And we'll have to leave it there for now. Carlos, thank you very much for your time. I look forward to speaking with you again in the near future.
Thank you, Don. My pleasure.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.